From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from Common Council President Cavalier Johnson on the news he could be taking over as acting mayor of Milwaukee. Then we'll speak with members from Governor Evers' Task Force on Student Debt about changing the conversation around education loans.
A lot of people have been told you have to borrow in order to get an education, that you need an education, and therefore having a giant student loan debt after you graduate is just the norm. I think that we need to turn that paradigm on its head.
Plus, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton reflects on the lessons of going virtual during the pandemic.
So my first response about the planetarium was, I was frightened. I thought, oh, they might just say, yeah, we're just closing this. My first visceral response was fear.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with a potentially big shakeup in city government. President Joe Biden announced last week that he's nominating Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett as the ambassador to Luxembourg. If the Senate approves that nomination under city charter, Common Council President Cavalier Johnson would become the acting mayor. A special election would be held later. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Johnson about his plans and priorities if he takes over for Barrett. He starts with a bit about his background.
The reason that I was interested in going into public service is because 20 years ago, I got involved in a pre-college program with the YMCA called Sponsor a Scholar. And I still wear this YMCA wristband every day to kind of remind me where I came from. The goal of that program was to get low-income kids in Milwaukee public schools like me off to college, and you know, usually we're the first people in our family to do that. The other part of that program is to get those same young people involved in community service and giving back. And I just fell in love with the community service aspect of it. Later that year, 9/11 happened, and you know, as a 14-year-old who likes video games and Batman and all that, I didn't take the day when I was home to do those things. I started watching the news and knew that I had to be aware of what was happening, not just in Milwaukee, but around the state, the country, and the world. And I saw, you know, President Bush go to the World Trade Center and try to bring people together. And then a light bulb went off in my head that I could marry the two. I could use government as the vehicle in which to serve people every day, like I did with the YMCA. And from 14 years old on, I never turned back.
And fast forwarding to now, we're in this kind of interesting situation where the mayor received a nomination for an ambassadorship. What would your priorities be going forward as acting mayor if all goes as planned and Mayor Barrett steps down for the ambassadorship?
Well, I think it's important for listeners to understand that in Milwaukee, we only have one mayor at a time. And right now, that mayor is Tom Barrett and will remain to be so until the point that he does decide to step down. Presumably after the Senate confirms his nomination as ambassador to Luxembourg. I can tell you there are a number of things that we've been focused on the Common Council and things that very likely will bleed over into the position of acting mayor. Chief among them, I think, are issues around our COVID response. You know, right now, we've got the very best tool at our disposal to attack and defeat COVID, and that's getting vaccinated. And so we want to encourage people, not just in this position as president, but in the position as acting mayor, and you know, hopefully if the people of Milwaukee will have me, to be elected mayor too, to get more people to get vaccinated. And right now is a perfect time to do it because the governor, Governor Evers, has sweetened the pot and is giving people $100 in order to do that when you get your vaccination. So that, and you know, we have issues, of course, around public safety as well that really need to be addressed. In my district, just in the course of the past couple of weeks, we've had a number of people who've lost their lives to needless, reckless driving over on 60th and Hampton, 76th and Silver Spring. I mean, even you know, some of the incidents that are happening, not by students at Marshall High School, but people going there, driving on the lawn and needlessly endangering the lives of those students there. So we have a lot to do around those areas, but there'll be more to talk about as we get there. Right now, I'm going to be focused on you know my day job as Second District Alderman and Common Council President.
But you did say that you are considering running for mayor when that does come about.
I did. And I will run for mayor 100%. Absolutely will do it when the time comes.
when that time comes and when the acting mayor time comes, if everything falls into a place, how might your priorities differ from current Mayor Barrett? Are there any areas where you'd like to change policy from what he's been doing?
Yeah, well, I'll say this, that, my experience in Milwaukee is different than Tom Barrett's experience. You know, I grew up in 53206. I grew up in some of the most depressed neighborhoods in Milwaukee. You know, reflecting on my own life, you know, I didn't have the opportunity to attend one school until I got to middle school to start and finish at the school. So from every grade in grade school, I was practically at another place. So I've seen Milwaukee via my education from the northwest side all the way to the south side of the city. So I know Milwaukee. I've seen Milwaukee. I've got that experience. I know all the love, but I know all the pain of, you know, areas like 53206. Also had the opportunity, like I said, to go off to college, like, you know, folks in our community encourage our young people to do. Went to UW-Madison, graduated there in 2005, and I did not take my ball and go to some other court. I came back here. I came back to do work here. I came back to use my talents to better my own community here in Milwaukee. And so I had the opportunity to work as a low-level staffer, but in the mayor's office. So I've been able to see that job up close. And now I've had the opportunity to serve not just as a member of the Common Council, representing the 2nd District, but also as Common Council President. And so I feel like I have this trifecta of experience, whether it be work experience, career experience, life experience, that makes me uniquely qualified to serve in the role of mayor. And because of those experiences that I had, my approach and the things that I focus on, I think, are going to be very different from what we've seen from the mayor over the course of the past 17 years.
Would you be able to elaborate on a few of those ways?
I think that, yeah, there'll be a lot of time to talk about those leading to the future. Right now, my focus is going to be, again, doing my job as County Council President, and when the time arises, as acting mayor of our city.
So you mentioned growing up in 53206. What does this mean for a city now to have an opening for mayor 17 years after 17 years with an incumbent who is tough to defeat? So could that be especially important to potential Black candidates and Black voters?
Oh, I mean, I think anytime there's an election, it's something that's important to African Americans and really all voters. I think that this presents a unique opportunity for the first time in the city of Milwaukee's history to elect a person of color to be the mayor. I know that some people are thinking that, you know, there'll be space to have the first Black mayor. That's not something that's on my mind, because in my mind that feat has already been accomplished. And nearly 20 years ago, when Marvin Pratt became mayor of Milwaukee, when he was acting mayor. That's not something that is particularly compelling to me. That's not what I'm in it for. I'm in it for the reasons that I mentioned. I want to create a Milwaukee that is strong, that is safe, that is stable, that creates opportunities for businesses, that creates opportunities for our families and for our youth, and creates an environment where folks have peaceful, quiet enjoyment of their neighborhoods. That's what I want to see.
And on that note of just improving things for citizens all around the city, Mayor Barrett did have his share of critics in the past 17 years, including some Black voters who felt like the Black community hasn't made enough economic progress under Barrett. What's your response to those types of criticisms?
I'm not going to respond to the criticisms against the mayor. The only thing I can do, I think, at this point is, again, focus on the task at hand, and leading the Common Council at this time, and then stepping into the role as acting mayor and doing what I can in order to correct what some of those criticisms were. Look, Milwaukee has had a lot of issues, especially economic issues, over the course of the last 40 years, and it's going to take, you know, a new way of thinking, a new approach in order to do that. And I think that this city is looking to the future. And when you look at, you know, some of the elected officials at all levels of government, but particularly the primary elected officials, you see that Milwaukee is looking to young people, looking to young millennials to lead us into the future. And I think I'm well poised to be that person to lead the city into the future. We're not talking about entering the 20th century now. We're talking about having a leader who can lead Milwaukee into the midpoint of the 21st century. And those are things that I think Milwaukeeans are going to be caring about.
One of the big things that our city has been grappling with is that even in the years before the pandemic, Wisconsin's unemployment level was at record lows, 2.8% in 2018. But again, to black unemployment levels for the city of Milwaukee, males between 25 and 54 from 2016 to 2018, the unemployment rate was 33.7%. How would you be focusing on that issue?
Well, like I said, I mean, there's going to be space to talk about all of these things in the future. After we have the opportunity to get into the office, there are ideas and things that I do have in mind that I'm glad to expound upon when we get there. But there's still a lot of runway that we need to cover in order to get to that point. But it is a salient one and something that's very important and something that's top of mind for me.
So what do you see as the city's other biggest challenges?
Sure. I mean, economic development certainly is one of those things. I mean, just touching back on the question that you asked previously is something that we desperately need to focus on. I think I mentioned earlier in our conversation issues around public safety, especially around issues like reckless driving. There are issues around public safety in terms of the members of the Fire and Police Commission and getting that to full strength. The issue of the fact that we haven't had a permanent police chief in Milwaukee for over a year now. We have to continue to build better ties and relationships with Madison because there's no way that you can move things forward in Milwaukee without having a strong relationship with Madison, with state government, with the legislature. And those are things that those are relationships I've been working to build in my time as County Council President. I'll continue to do that as acting mayor. And again, if the people of Milwaukee are gracious enough to elect me, I'll be working on those as mayor as well, hopefully.
President Cavalier Johnson and potential acting mayor of the city of Milwaukee, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Cavalier Johnson is the Milwaukee Common Council president. He could be taking over as acting mayor if the Senate approves the president's nomination of Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett as the ambassador to Luxembourg. Johnson spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. We have more on this at WUWM.com, including what Barrett had to say about his 17 years as mayor and how people in Milwaukee are reacting to the news. Coming up in about 25 minutes, we'll tell you how Sharp Literacy is helping students get hands-on experience with urban gardening. But first, we'll hear from members of Governor Tony Evers' Task Force on Student Debt about what long-term solutions are needed to eradicate student debt. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee Area Technical College and UW-Milwaukee recently announced they're providing debt relief for any outstanding balances incurred from the 2020-2021 school year. Both institutions used federal COVID-19 relief funds, providing a short-term solution to a larger issue. Student debt in Wisconsin totals $24 billion, according to a 2017 report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Governor Tony Evers created a task force dedicated to assessing student debt in Wisconsin and providing long-term solutions. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang spoke with two members of Governor Evers' Task Force on Student Debt. Karen Bauer is an attorney for a consumer protection unit at the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. Silby Isin is a UW-Milwaukee graduate student and a financial aid advisor at the university.
Student debt, as we all know, is a national problem, especially in Wisconsin. And Karen and Silby, you both were on Governor Evers' task force on student debt. From your time on the task force, what were the main causes of students in Wisconsin incurring debt?
For the record, the views that I'm going to talk about today are my own based on my experience as a student loan lawyer and student and not those of my employer. Higher education is expensive, and it has gotten even more expensive over the past 20 years, especially when compared to the average starting salaries for graduates. When I attended the University of Wisconsin Law School, we frequently talked about how 30 or 40 years ago, people could pay for law school with a part-time job. That definitely is not the case anymore. And the accelerating cost of all higher education just means that most students don't have the money to pay for it.
The views I express are my own, not reflective of my employer or anyone, but besides my own professional and personal judgment. Higher education realm has expanded and increased in, you know, its expenses. It has, I believe, inadvertently and indirectly given those expenses to higher education students, those wanting to pursue a degree. But I feel like there is a disproportion between the cost of education and the narrative at times of society about harshly guiding, I'll call it, students saying that you need a degree, you need to go to school, you need a degree for higher, you know, higher education in order to thrive or survive in, you know, in the market, in the economy, in this country. And yet I feel that there is a gap between wanting to obtain that, but also just wanting to have a peaceful existence.
I agree with that. And I also think that there are some quintessentially American forces at play here. And one of those is our desire for immediate gratification in our society. For many students, they have heard, and I heard, student debt is good debt. I think a lot of people have been told that you have to borrow in order to get an education, that you need an education, and therefore having a giant student loan debt after you graduate is just the norm. I think that we need to turn that paradigm on its head.
Student debt is good debt. I don't know how many times I've heard that. And Sylvie, you were a student, you were a college student while you were on the task force for student debt. You currently are still getting your master's degree. And during your time on the task force, even now, like, what do you hear about the impact of taking out student loans and now repaying that and trying to figure all that out?
I always see this a lot between families, the middle income, the middle class families. I kind of feel like they're in a tight spot where they make a certain amount in their income where they could, you know, technically pay for school, but yet it's at such a high price where it's out of reach. However, they don't make anything below a certain threshold in income to qualify for additional grants or funding or anything alternative. And yet they feel that that degree is out of reach, and it's disproportionately out of reach for that very reason. You know, when I hear parents who want to help pay, but they literally do not have the funding, and going out and telling them, you know, go to a bank or a credit union and take out a, you know, a private loan with 12, 13, 14, 15% interest, that's not too kind on a bank account or a wallet. It's not. And to tell them that it's okay to do this, or you should do this, it's not a big deal. It is. When I was on the debt task force and we listened to a lot of cases about people and their debt stories, sometimes it comes down to, even when I speak to students and families, it comes down to, had I known that, then there would have been a better outcome. And I feel like just one slip by just someone not knowing something, and again, it's not anything on fault or personal blame, nothing of that sort, no. It just, had that information been given to you, there would have been such a brighter path. And it's hard to see that same recurring pattern over and over again, that one has to think to themselves, why is it happening over and over again? There has to be a way to combat this. There has to be a way to change it. So what I do, and the best that I can do, is that I try to arm those who speak with me with knowledge and information. And at the end of the day, it's not me telling you what to do. It's me giving you the information and you making the decision for what's best for you to do. Because at the end of the day, it is about freedom and choice, but it's also about being informed.
Yeah, and something from the report that you all helped to create on the task force that really stuck out to me is that student debt doesn't impact just the student taking out the debt. There's parents, there's guardians, there's a whole community that this debt impacts. So Karen, You're a lawyer that practices and has dedicated a lot of your career, the majority of your career, I would say, to fixing and figuring out a solution to this issue that we're talking about today. In your time as a lawyer and your time researching these challenges, what should students, parents, guardians know before taking out a loan and signing on the dotted line?
I think that there are a couple of things at play here. One thing I wanted to mention is that over the 13 years that I've been working on and looking at these issues, I have seen the population of individuals that contact me for help has gotten older and older and older. And we have quite a few senior citizens, people who are receiving Social Security, who are also attempting to pay back both their own student loan debt or the student loan debt for their children. And I think the most important thing, and we had discussed this at length on the task force, is that some of the efforts to educate students are taking place, or people want them to take place, when that student is entering school, they're starting college, but it is already too late at that point. Nobody is going to show up at UWM and then decide to go home once they hear that they'll be borrowing $15,000 a semester. That's just not happening. But I also feel like so many people don't understand how much that student loan is going to cost relative to the student's income upon graduation. You know, there are certain fields have a fairly low starting wage, which will make it very difficult for someone to pay back $200,000 in student loan debt. And I also think that so many times people forget about or scoff at the idea of attending a two-year institution like Milwaukee Area Technical College in order to keep that student loan debt down.
And this question is for the both of you. Colleges like MATC and UWM this year are providing financial relief for all students who attended the schools during the 2020 to 2021 school year from federal COVID-19 relief funds from the U.S. Department of Education. This specifically was a very special circumstance because of the pandemic. What are the long-term solutions that are needed to eradicate student debt and to ensure that folks aren't drowning in their debt?
One of the policy proposals that had come out of Governor Evers' task force was the idea to have an office for a student loan ombudsperson. And that office, the whole point of it was to provide information and advice for Wisconsinites to help them deal with their student loan debt and to prevent a crushing amount of student loan debt from negatively impacting Wisconsin residents going forward. I really was disappointed that the legislature in Wisconsin chose not to fund that provision. I commend MATC and UWM for using these pandemic funds in order to alleviate some debt for students, but this is not the norm. The level of funding that these institutions have been given because of the pandemic, unfortunately, is a unique situation. But I would make the argument that if we agree that education is a public good, and I think we do, we need to fund it as such. Our public higher education institutions in Wisconsin have received decreased funding over time. And I think it's time to reverse that trend and ensure that everyone can go to school if it's a suitable thing for them, and that we're not restricting those able to get an education to people whose families are wealthy or whom are going into fields that pay a lot of money, because some of the most valuable things in our society, unfortunately, don't have the salary to match. I'm thinking of teaching. Full disclosure, my spouse is an MPS teacher, and that is not an extremely lucrative profession, but it is so needed in order for us to have a functioning society.
I understand that students who are at a younger age and who are new to the higher education process and taking out loans, I see the excitement in their eyes when they sign off on a loan for $5,000, $10,000. And I say to myself, do you understand what you're signing off to? Do you understand the guidance and the responsibility that comes with signing off on that? because I have returning students who come back, you know, to see me or at the office and mention, you know, I signed off on these loans 7-8 years ago, and now they're coming knocking at my mailbox, time for repayment. It's again about just giving you that information about it may not seem like it's a burden that it's going to bother you now, but it absolutely will in years' time. But just understanding your cost of attendance, your cost of attending school, the loans that you need to take out, and just keeping on top of that. One thing I wanted to advocate for is a type of budgeting and financing for like incoming freshmen who come in, to understand that what does it take to finance school, or even those who are seniors in high school, to have a review session about what it takes to pay for college. It can be a very difficult conversation. It can be a very tedious one, and it can be one that makes people uncomfortable, but it's one that needs to be had to students out there. If there's something you don't understand, please ask. No question is ever a silly one. Please ask, because it's only for the betterment of your understanding. And if you don't understand, best not to do anything with it anyway. Turning that around to UWM and MATC using the funding, a lot that I get in my office is students are not able to continue with school if they have an outstanding balance owed from a previous semester. So utilizing these funds to essentially cancel that debt allows students to move forward so that they can enroll in classes again, so that they can pursue their degree, and they can just get that one semester even closer to graduating. Since the press release was made to the public, it gave a lot of relief to students. Personally, those who spoke with me mentioned how having that debt relieved allowed them to give a sigh of relief. Now they can have one less thing on their mind to be able to enroll and continue pursuing their degree. So it absolutely is a short-term relief, absolutely. But college and higher education shouldn't be this much. It should not be this expensive. And if it were, there should be needs to be met with that. We need to start shifting the infrastructure. So there needs to be that discussion of making college affordable and having those that wish to pursue higher education and a degree to do so.
I also wanted to kind of touch on something that you alluded to, which is that, you know, there are student debt alleviation mechanisms present in the federal student loan system. And I think we would be remiss not to chat about those. You know, recently, the U.S. Department of Education did an about face policy-wise when it comes to people who owe student loans who are disabled and receiving Social Security disability. And they decided that if they met certain criteria, that they no longer needed to apply for a student loan discharge. You know, it's called a total and permanent disability discharge. Previously, people had to fill out paperwork stating that they were on SSDI for a disability and had to meet certain criteria for the receipt of that SSDI in order to get a discharge. Now the government is going to do it automatically for a portion of those SSDI recipients. And it's about time. There was no need for one government agency to need to talk to another agency through this form in order to get rid of that debt. They're now going to do it directly, which I think is an important policy idea to help those individuals who got an education and became disabled later. And there's also the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. You know, that program requires students to pay 120 income-driven payments while working in a public service sector employer, like teaching or government or as a police officer, et cetera. But that program, as we all know, has been, I think we can call it, a failure. Overwhelmingly, those who have applied for loan forgiveness have been unable to get it, myself excepted. I received $160,000 in student loan forgiveness for working at my low-paid legal services position for 10 years. But the only way that I was able to take advantage of that program is because I literally do student loan law for a living. It shouldn't require an attorney in order to take advantage of a program that was meant to encourage people to enter public service positions. So many of these programs want to help people once they've already been saddled with debt. And I think it might be time for us to look at throwing that idea out the window, trying to make school more affordable on the front end so that we're not talking about debt anymore. We're talking about affordability.
Thank you both for being here on Lake Effect with me. Thank you, Karen and Sylvie, for chatting with me today.
You're welcome. Anytime, Mallory.
Thanks so much, Mallory.
Karen Bauer is an attorney for a consumer protection unit at the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. Sylvie Isin is a UW-Milwaukee graduate student and a financial aid advisor at the university. They spoke to Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Starting next month, UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium will welcome people back for public events. That's after a year of only hosting virtual events. It's an exciting milestone for astronomy contributor Jean Creighton, who directs the planetarium. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the program's virtual existence for the last 15 months. And she begins by reflecting on what she was feeling at the start of the pandemic.
I don't think I had capacity to think about the long term. I think I was grasping, because I was teaching also a university course, I was just going from week to week, okay, so what does this mean for this week? And the data was changing within every day. You know, you'd have one guideline in the morning and then you'd have some other story by the afternoon. So my first response about the planetarium was, I was frightened. I thought, oh, they might just say, yeah, we're just closing this. My first visceral response was fear. And then I thought, you know, we can do things remotely. We in principle, we can do this. I needed then to understand some of the technical aspects of this, how to make it work. So I was given a gift. Very early in this conversation, so I think it was the second week of March, maybe the third, I was approached by the Alumni Association at UWM. They wanted a series of programs that was intended for families, alumni who now have young families, as something, as a gift, as something special that alumni could use now, especially when school at that point was completely virtual. And families were scrambling, working from home while also trying to educate and entertain, keep safe their children. So I said, yes, I will do this. And we came up with a program called Stars Have Stories. I think I did 9 segments, about 15 minutes each. And there were 15 minutes of questions each time. This sounds perhaps like a fairly small project, but in fact, I estimate that every 15 minutes took me about 8 hours to prepare. And of course, you know this because you do this kind of thing for a living, but for the uninitiated, it was a real eye-opener. I very much enjoyed the program because I wanted it to be, yes, for children, but I didn't want to be I wanted to have substance. I wanted to talk about stars in a way that was interesting, engaging, they could understand, but it wasn't total fluff. Well, when I sort of sank my teeth into that project, I thought, and they were taking care of, the Alumni Association people were taking care of all the technical aspects of this. I thought, I can do this. I could do virtual programming. And yes, I miss having a live audience asking questions in person. And I certainly miss I look around the room and I see, oh, they're getting it, or no, that totally didn't fly. I need to re-say that. But people put things in the chat, and that's live. That's interaction that in some ways has an intimacy too. And it also gives voices to people who might not have asked a question in person. So I perked up. I thought, I really like this. And we started doing programming in the planetarium. And I am thrilled to tell you that from June of 2020 to June 2021, we had 14,000 people engaged with our programs.
How does that compare to what you had kept track of pre-COVID with audience numbers?
It's very close. In my 15 years I've been here, we've had years with fewer people. I mean, that would have been earlier in my time, but still, this is amazing as far as I'm concerned. And about 80% of that were people who were watching our programs live. The 20% were watching them on demand. I was surprised how many people did that. So I feel like there's a need, and for many people in isolation, you know, this was something to do on a Friday night or whenever they had an opportunity. And that also felt good to bring back something to the community where, you know, older adults, but anybody who might have been frightened to go out in a closed space, this way they could follow a program and interact without feeling any concern.
When it comes to being in a planetarium, you know, you have the sky above you in a different way compared to when you're outdoors, depending on conditions, but, you know, it's really at your fingertips. And how did you want to, obviously not recreate this experience, but still give people enough immersion into the night sky, or depending on your presentations, how did you want to best deliver that in a virtual setting?
So that was a hard one. And I think the honest answer there, Audrey, is that we couldn't and we didn't try. Like the sky that's produced in the planetarium, you can't. If it was easy to do, then planetariums would have gone out of business. It's not easy. And we did try a little bit of virtual stargazing and using software and, you know, this and that. But I decided that given that we were virtual, it made more sense to make programs shorter, to focus on the topic, to give extra time for questions because people did ask more questions. And that's exciting in and of itself, that you've inspired curiosity and now people want more. So that was a fun thing to learn, that if it's virtual, you can focus the topic and give more chances for the audience to ask you what they're curious about, as opposed to answering questions that nobody asked.
Have you been able to cover more diverse topics and things you haven't done before because you had this shift and let's do shorter, more concentrated presentations and let's expand our arsenal of what we present to people?
Certainly Stars Have Stories was like that. That wouldn't have been something I would have done. I don't have time normally. I also did some SoundCloud stuff. I love Greek mythology. As you know, I grew up in Greece, and for many years, I thought, oh, I just want to tell these stories the way I want to and say the names the way they're supposed to be. So I finally had an opportunity to do that. So there are some recordings that you can find on our website of stories that connect to constellations. One of the things virtual could do for us that we couldn't do otherwise was that we could get speakers who live somewhere else. So if I wanted, for example, to have a Chilean astronomer talk about Chilean astronomy and Chilean culture, I certainly don't have the budget to fly him in to come in live, but he could join us virtually. And I don't think I was thinking in those terms before COVID. If I can't get them here, what am I going to do? But now I see, oh, I have options. And in fact, this was so successful that we're going to do it again this fall. And that's the sort of cool exchange programming that you just can't do otherwise.
Well, and you are going to resume some live programming in September. And as you mentioned, you're still going to keep some virtual stuff or bring in virtual presenters, kind of a hybrid of the lessons you've learned. What excites you the most about returning to the planetarium with people, yet combining all of the resources and lessons you've adapted to?
I can't wait to have a full house. I have had some private programs where they're like two people, five people, that just can't have the energy that a full house has. So the possibility of sharing a beautiful night sky with the full house in the planetarium is thrilling to me now. So I hope we'll be able to do that for the first time on September 1st with our very popular program called Stars and S'mores. Everyone is welcome. This is part of a fall welcome for students, but it is open to the community and it is free from 8 to 10.
Well, I know the community will be looking forward to the return to the planetarium just as much as you are, and I look forward to continuing our conversations each month. Thanks, Jean.
Thanks so much, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is Lake Effect's regular astronomy contributor and the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The planetarium's first public event, called Stars and S'mores, will be held outdoors the evening of September 1st. You can find more information at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn why Sharp Literacy decided to help revitalize an urban greenhouse for Milwaukee students.
It's easy to talk about an aquaponics system in a classroom, but when you actually walk into the greenhouse and you see it, it just makes things easier to understand.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Gardening is a great way to learn about a lot of things, like where your food comes from, the work it takes to get a vegetable from seed to plate, and even how ecosystems work. But these are lessons best learned in a hands-on environment, which can be inaccessible for a lot of city dwellers. Sharp Literacy wanted to help Milwaukee kids get this experience. So with help from organizations around the city, they renovated a greenhouse at Browning Elementary in Milwaukee's West Lawn neighborhood. Linda Kohler is the president and CEO of Sharp Literacy, and she joins me now to talk about this project. Linda, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having us. Me.
Tell us a bit about this site. This isn't a greenhouse that you're building whole cloth, but instead a greenhouse that you're reviving.
Yes. So in 2017, we were walking back from an event that we had with Ryan Braun and Silver Spring Neighborhood Center, their summer programming. And I looked and I had never seen the greenhouse. And I asked Tom Ellis, who was the executive director at Silver Spring Neighborhood Center at the time, what was going on in that greenhouse? And he said, absolutely nothing. What would you like to do with it? And I said, you know, give me a day or so and I'll let you know. So I talked to Mike Carrier, who was the author of our book, Urban Agriculture, which we use in our summer programming, after school programming, and our third grade curriculum, and asked him if he would want to be a part of a team to revitalize the greenhouse. And, you know, without any hesitation, he said absolutely he would. We started from them. We put a team together. We started this a couple of years ago, actually probably 2018. And it's just, we revitalized it. We worked with MSOE honor students who developed a solar dehydrator. They say it's the largest in the state of Wisconsin. I think it's the largest in this region, as well as an aquaponics system. So we started with that. And now we've added a lot. We have a hydroponic system. We have three raised garden beds, LED lights so that we can actually do starter plants. So it's a year-round greenhouse. It's not just in the summer. And we want to continue to, you know, just add to the, it's such a great learning tool for our students. So we use it not only for our summer programming, but we also use it for our academic year programming with Browning students.
So you mentioned a few of the ways that this greenhouse has been revitalized. As you're looking at the new things inside of this, what are kids going to be learning about?
Well, and we're a STEAM-based program, so all of the greenhouse really is touches on a lot of the STEAM components. So they're going to learn what an aquaponics system does, how the fish, you know, how the fish poop actually fertilizes and has the plants grow in one system. They're going to learn hydroponics. So they're going to see how the fish, you know, provide the nutrients for the plants. And then they're going to see the hydroponics, how the water will neutralize the hydroponics system, which is they can produce almost 25 pounds of whatever vegetable we have in there in 1 month's time. They're going to learn about raised garden beds. They're going to learn all about harvesting, planting, harvesting, watering, picking the weeds out of it, and what they can do with, you know, the fresh vegetables. Many of them have never had zucchini and tomatoes, and so we've done some really great things of providing them with the opportunity to taste and eat, you know, tomatoes and zucchini bread and salsa, and really find out that vegetables can not only healthy for you, but they're also very good tasting. So they're learning about science. That's what aquaponics is. Technology. We have added a system where from the classroom, from home, they can actually go on and see they can see the fish. They can see, feel what the temperature is, what the pH is. They can automatically feed the fish as well. So that's the technology part of it. We have art, which is the A in STEAM. We have murals that are on the outside of the greenhouse. We just recently did a butterfly. So they're learning about pollination. So all kinds of, you know, STEAM concepts that are just unique. They don't realize that this is science or technology or art. So they're learning so much in a relatively small space. But it's just something that they've never experienced before.
As you alluded to, this area is considered a food desert. Is this greenhouse a way of responding to that need in this community?
It is in a small way. The kids were able to bring the fresh vegetables. Our program was Tuesdays and Thursdays. So they were actually able to bring a bag and bring home. They would be able to pick the vegetables and then bring them home. We would provide them with recipe cards. Also, Silver Spring Neighborhood Center has a food bank. So we were able to provide different types of cilantro, tomatoes, zucchini that we would bring them to the food bank. So they would be able to also, you know, give those out to the community as they picked up their food bags on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We eventually would love to have a farmer's market and have teaching the kids about financial literacy as well, and have a plant sale. So yeah, they're learning to eat healthy, even though that where they live, it may not be accessible to them, but they know where they can get it.
As we look at things like aquaponics or even starting new plants and learning how to create that kind of a system, why do you think this type of education is important for kids?
Because it's hands-on, it's easier for kids to learn. And I know I'm a visual learner. It's an easier way for them to remember. So when they see a system like an aquaponic system and they see the fish, and we have, you know, great signage, so they can kind of see, not kind of, they can see how the fish and how the nutrition from the fish poop actually grows, you know, the vegetables or herbs, whatever it is. So it's system. So they're learning about systems. They're learning about the technology through the system, the monitoring system, on how they can, you know, now with technology, you know, either on their computer or on a smartphone, pull up and see the fish and see how's the temperature, you know, we need to feed them. They can, the pH balance and all of that. So they're learning and they're experiencing all of this visually. It's easy to talk about an aquaponic system in a classroom, but when you actually walk into the greenhouse and you see it, it just makes things easier to understand. We had a great partnership with Will Allen and Growing Power, which is right down the street. And prior to the greenhouse, the kids would be able to do their educational tour at Growing Power. So again, that they hear all these concepts they're learning about in the book, in our urban agriculture book. But when you go in and you see these concepts, you visually see aquaponics in the soil and how important good soil is, and the worms in the soil. What does that do? Why does that, you know, produce great soil? It's just an experience that these kids would never probably have without, you know, sharp literacy. And then they're going to remember that. They're going to go home and you know, their parents ask them, what did you learn today? Oh, I learned about, you know, an aquaponic system. I know that in third grade, I didn't know what an aquaponic system was. So it's this, just these experiences that help them remember and kind of have that that love of learning and that inquiry and curiosity at a very young age.
All right. Well, Linda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and congratulations on the new greenhouse.
Thank you so much.
Linda Kohler is the president and CEO of Sharp Literacy. The group recently renovated a greenhouse for its STEAM programming, teaching kids about a variety of things surrounding horticulture. If you're interested in horticulture and gardening, you can find more of our coverage on these topics at WUWM.com, including our Dig In series with Venus Williams. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about zero net energy home design and a competition challenging UW-Milwaukee students to create them. Plus, we'll talk with the Hmong American Women's Association about their new home inside the historic Pabst Mansion. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.